Rapport, the Informal Ethnographer Podcast. Episode 4, Preparing for the Field. Hello and welcome to this fourth episode of Rapport, the Informal Ethnographer Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Enkerly. Today I want to talk about preparing for the field. So still a pretty broad topic, pretty generic one. But I think it's a good idea to go by concentric circles and go from the more general to the more specific. In this case, I was talking in earlier episodes about theory and epistemology, and then about what it means to be a field worker, and now about a little bit more specific about what it is to prepare for the field. Under that heading of preparing for a field, I include a number of things. It's pretty general, but I mean, before you can go and do your field work, what should you do? The general concept is that you need to be prepared for the unexpected. Seems contradictory to a certain extent, but it has to do with something I keep talking about in these episodes, about the flexibility of ethnography in general. So, to prepare for the unexpected mostly means that you actually know enough about ethnography in general and enough about your topic, your research topic, to be able to cope with what goes on in the field. The first part of this, the most obvious part, is training. So, you need to be trained in some of those ethnographic disciplines to be an ethnographer. There's actually a lot of debate about this, or a one-sided kind of a debate, one-sided discussion of ethnographers who are trained in ethnographic disciplines who say that there are people who claim to be ethnographers or claim to be using ethnography somehow who are not trained in ethnographic disciplines. And there's maybe a conflict between those two positions, and I'm assuming that the one position, which is more, in a way, silent, those people who are using ethnography somehow without necessarily having a background also have something to say about ethnography in general. But the notion is that to be an ethnographer, you need to be trained in one of those ethnographic disciplines. In episode 2, I was talking about ethnographic disciplines, and I think even episode 1, actually. There's a number of those. Cultural anthropology is one, is an obvious one, but so is microsociology, and folkloristics is a traditional one, historical one, and that still exists, obviously, but that we tend not to think about. So any of those ethnographic disciplines is a good context to prepare, to train yourself in ethnography somehow. And ethnography here is meant really mostly as an approach, as I keep saying in this podcast, but at the same time, it does imply that you're trained in some of those methods. So the notion here is that ethnographers, real ethnographers, are distinct from other people. One distinction there is with people who are, in fact, more travelers. So it can be traveling for any reason, including just for fun, for personal reasons, or it can be people who were travelers during colonial times, or missionaries, or journalists, actually, and travel writers. There is a difference between traveling and ethnography itself as an ethnographic fieldwork. I tend not to emphasize that part so much, but there's a clear difference. I remember a discussion between an anthropologist in Switzerland and I think would-be student, or possibly a student in his course, saying, well, I was doing ethnography because I went back to my home, and I think it was in China. It might actually be somewhere completely different. But I think it was China, saying, well, I went back to my family. I know these things. And this kind of observation can be interesting and even insightful. And we tend to rely on something similar sometimes during ethnographic fieldwork, but the attitude is very different, and part of which has to do with training. Ethnographers are trained in a specific way to notice things in a way that I keep saying is more holistic than detailed, but there's also a level of detail that comes with the kind of observation we do. So it's not just about noticing random things, disparate things, but it's actually about noticing patterns in what we see. And those patterns may not seem statistically significant, but they seem to us to be culturally significant, usually because they integrate different things that we also notice at the same time. There's even something that needs to be addressed in terms of doing fieldwork from memory. It's not a very common thing to talk about, but there seems to be this notion from some people who went somewhere traveling, sometimes to their home culture, quote-unquote, home cultural context, sometimes to different places, and they notice things. And it's coming back that they say, oh, this is what I noticed. And from memory, they would be able, in their mind, they would be able to do something that they find is ethnographic. Ethnography itself as a whole, as an approach, is not about those simple random observations, disconnected observations. And certainly memory is very important, but what happens during the fieldwork, and we've talked about that a little bit, I've talked about that a little bit in the past, cannot be done from memory. Because you prepare in a certain way, and that's pretty much the context for what I want to talk about today, that it's not just about traveling and coming back with some notes that you had in your head. You can make head notes while you're in the field, but it's not just about remembering random things. It's that you have a research project. It seems very obvious, and sometimes the way ethnographers' work make it seem so simple, the difference is not that clear. So the main difference between traveling just like that and doing ethnographic field research from that point of view is based on training and on your goals. Speaking of goals, one of the most important things in terms of preparation for the field, and probably the most obvious, as in any research project, is choosing your topic. That one is very obvious, obviously, but it's still important to think about, and there are different ways to approach that. Some people approach it as they have one issue they want to talk about, one ethnographic topic, and they want to talk about it, and they want to find a place where it's relevant. So let's say a broad topic such as gender, but maybe, gender discrepancies in, in household chores or something else. And they will choose some place that will give them that. Or maybe it's about conflict resolution, and maybe they will choose a site, a field site, that is rife with conflict. There are also some people who choose the place first, the field site first, and then choose a topic based on what they notice seems to be relevant and significant for the local context. And in some cases, that can be, well, either issue-based or place-based. It can be fairly personal. There are some people who will choose a field site based on being married with someone from that place, or just being interested in something, cuisine from that place or music from that place. And it's a personal preference that they have, or personal attraction that they have to the place, and that's a basis for their personal choice of what they'll do as research. It sounds possibly a little bit strange coming from other disciplines and other approaches in social sciences or elsewhere, especially in hard sciences, actually. It's probably fairly rare that, well, I don't know, actually, but it sounds like it would be rare for a biochemist to be doing research on this given protein based on their personal passion. But at the same time, it might be personal in the sense that they want to work with this mentor that they had, a biochemist with whom they were working, and he happens or she happens to work on this protein. The same thing with all sorts of personal issues that might happen in other disciplines. In ethnographic disciplines, it's very common to have some personal involvement with something about your topic. There's something that you're passionate about. Passion is okay as a basis for a choice of fieldwork. And it can happen in academia, but it can also happen in the private sector or any form of ethnography that can be done. So sometimes your background will count. If you're a nurse, let's say a registered nurse, and you want to work on patient care and the perception patients have of the care that they're given, well, there's a personal connection there based on your background. At the same time, it's a very specific topic that that has to do with applied anthropology in that case, or some other discipline, and it's a perfectly legitimate choice. There are also some political choices. Fairly frequently, it happens anywhere in academia and in ethnography, or in any kind of research, actually. And in ethnography, in ethnographic disciplines, it's fairly common to choose a topic or an issue or a site based on some political issues. And I mean by that mostly office politics, or even just, this is a trendy topic now, so you should address it because, somebody has to work on it. Or somebody else in the same department is working on something similar, but you can, overlap with her research, something like that. Once you've selected a topic, the next logical step is to prepare your project. It's fairly obvious, and it also is very similar to any other research project you can get, either in academia or the private sector or anything like that. One thing that's somewhat different in ethnography is that the project design tends to be fairly flexible. You can plan a number of things, and I was saying that you need to be prepared for the unexpected. So in this case, the design of your project needs to be somewhat flexible, because otherwise you can have all sorts of surprises, and you need to have something. Usually these days we suggest that people have something of a hypothesis so that they can get something back directly applicable to their research project. At the same time, it needs to be fairly broad so that you can take advantage of what goes on in the field. It's very common for people to really change their focus while in the field. And it may be based on practical issues, but it may be based on an understanding of what goes on that will change during the field. There are all sorts of examples. In the field, for instance, a lot of what happened to me was mostly corroboration and confirmation of ideas I had, but there were a few things that I really just realized while I was there. There were moments of, eureka moments of intense insight based on something someone said and that I couldn't have foreseen in my project design. So, for instance, in my case in Mali, about connections between blacksmiths, griots, so-called griots or bards, and hunters, and also to a certain extent sorcerers or those who do their witchcraft. The relationship between those people, I was thinking about that during, all the years I was involved with this project. But while in the field, at one point, I just realized I had a eureka moment about those connections, and it really put every piece of the puzzle now was fitting. everything fit, and that was an important moment that I couldn't have foreseen. I couldn't have expected that I would be working on really on those connections, that it's a social network of practitioners in knowledge fields, knowledge workers, the bards, blacksmiths, hunters, and sorcerers. I couldn't have predicted that, or I wasn't thinking about that before, very specifically before going back to the field. So it's the kind of thing that you need to have a broad project design so that you can take advantage of those moments. But of course, at the same time, these days, especially in North America, I think, well, in the US and Canada, as far as I know, I'm pretty sure it's the same thing in Europe and probably in other parts of the world, you need to go through institutionalized review board, institutional review boards. And it's the whole thing about informed consent, which is very important. They're not ethics committees per se. They're fairly similar. But at the same time, they're interdisciplinary, which can be a very good thing, but tends to apply some problems from other disciplines into the case of ethnographic research. So ethnographic disciplines tend to cope with some similar issues in terms of ethics, but those review boards tend to have an approach that is not that compatible with ethnographic disciplines. It's not as bad now, it's not as hard now to present research for ethnographic approaches, ethnographic disciplines, to review boards like these, because we're now used to say those things that they want to hear. We're kind of prepared by that. But at least in academia, there's a lot of work that needs to be done that, okay, how many subjects will you have? Well, it's not something that you typically know in advance with ethnographic research, but it's the kind of thing that you need to have in mind when you prepare the project just for the review board. It doesn't matter so much for the research itself. It depends, actually. Sometimes it can matter a lot. But typically, especially if you recruit subjects, quote-unquote, through a snowball method, so that you meet someone who introduces you to a second person and you go through the network to reach other people, you don't know in advance how many people you will get, and that might not be that important. For private sector research, for market research, it's fairly typical to know, you know, more or less how many people you'll be working with. But for typical academic research, you don't know in advance so much what will happen in terms of number of people with whom you'll talk. Maybe for formal interviews you do know, but for more informal contacts, there's no way to know in advance. But review boards typically look for things like that. So in terms of preparation, you need to prepare your mind to go through the review board, and actually they can stop your research, and they're there to protect mostly people who are seen as, perceived as subjects, and you know, they do an important job, but the way it's set up is not really conducive to ethnographic research. So you need to prepare yourself for that, and it can be an ordeal. Most people I know who've been through those review boards talk about it as, you know, a difficult experience, or never as something very positive. I might say that it did help me somehow to frame my research in a specific way that was useful in the field. And in fact, when I had people sign those informed consent forms, people in Mali, at least, were interested in the process. They perceived it in their own way, which was that, well, if I sign that form, what I give you is more respected, which is not untrue. There's something to it, that by signing that form, they're, of course, named, and it's more connected to who they are, possibly. At the same time, it didn't change my respect for people with whom I work. In fact, the very notion that they are human subjects doesn't sound dismissive per se, but they're more than that to me. So I respect them more than mere human subjects, which to me sounds like almost a human zoo with a slight touch of respect. I tend to be a humanist, so I respect everyone, and those forms didn't change anything. But still, something that you have to think about. The next very important step in terms of preparation, another one that's common to all research projects, and that is connected to project design and even the review boards, at least for academic research, is funding. In private sector ethnography, funding comes from a client and, well, supposedly, in most cases, I would guess, maybe from a third party, but it's still a client. So it's fairly obvious that you only do the research when you get the contract, basically. Or maybe it's possible that some people will just go about doing an actual research project design and look for funding afterwards in the private sector. I don't think it happens a lot. In academia, it's certainly very common that you prepare a project and then you propose, you do a proposal, a formal proposal to get funding. The funding is supposedly about the research project that will be done. Some people, I've heard some people who do the opposite, not necessarily in ethnography actually, but some people who do the project, the actual proposal, based on something they've done before, and then apply for funding based on that project, and they will do something else and change the project design. I find it's a little bit sneaky, and it's not very common. And I think in ethnography, it's kind of hard to do. You can do follow-up research, but the project design is so different every time you go that I don't think it would work so well. But so basically, you prepare what will happen. You plan. You do a project plan, and you present that. And it's fairly similar to what you present to review board. And then it has to do with budget and such. If you're a student, a graduate student, because usually it's actually fairly rare for undergraduate students, but it also exists. If you're a graduate student, it has to do with what your department has, who trains you, who is your mentor, who is your chair, the chair of your committee, research committee, and then it goes through the department, and there's almost like a contest. It relates even to your grades very often. But the project design does count, and people want to know that you're not, well, that you will bring back data, and hopefully that you will finish the project. Academic projects, especially for graduate school, they tend to be fairly long. For PhD level ethnographic research, we're talking about a number of years, and a number of years of very significant funding. Other academic research can be done, fairly short projects. Even some people who have complete labs to do ethnographic research in a certain region, they can still have sub-projects that are, fairly well-defined. As far as I know, in the private sector, the projects are really well-defined and tend to be in a matter of months, if not weeks, and you're done, and the funding relates to really just that, and you need to be done by that time. And I think there's a high rate of, maybe not success, but at least that you finish the research in time. A further set of steps, and they're somewhat in a chronological order, somewhat in a logical order, but at the same time, those things all happen pretty much at the same, in the same period of time. And sometimes it's important to do the following. before you finish the project design, but at the same time, you think about all of these things at the same time, and they can be helpful together. So it's about people. And again, I'm a humanist and I do social science and humanities, so I think a lot about people. I hope somehow that everything we do is related to people. But what I mean is basically making contacts. And the first thing, possibly either chronologically or at least conceptually, is to make contacts with other researchers. They're not the most important, maybe, but it might be a good idea to start with that. And even in the private sector, I've done exactly that, that I went before meeting people with whom I was working in the field, quote unquote, I actually went to meet researchers, and I also learned a lot about other researchers in the same field, not necessarily on the same type of project, but at least, you know, people with whom I could, well, from whom I could gain some knowledge, some insight about the type of project I would do. And it's part of training to a certain extent, but it's probably less necessary, at least as a first step, once you're used to research, to that the type of research you do. But it's certainly important to go meet researchers in your field. So if you want to do your project in Africa, once you've chosen your project, you can start meeting Africanists and go attend some conferences and meeting people and making contacts, so through email or anything else, but also through books, through readings. I still think of it as making contacts, or at least the same type of preparation. You get to know who's involved. So it can be about the field site, or it can be about a set of issues. So let's say you want to talk about cultural revolutions. Well, you can talk to specialists in the Chinese cultural revolution, even though you want to work about cultural revolution somewhere else. In academia, it's fairly common to start with colleagues, with or would-be colleagues, researchers in the field. In the private sector, it can be pretty important. So you're thinking about specialists of your topic or your field site, and that can be pretty important as a first step. Maybe you'll notice that the research has already been done, or that you actually don't get along with people who work in that field, and that can be fairly important, because, you know, if you have to fight your way through the research, maybe it's not the kind of fight you want to take on. And some other people, they actually want to be in a very contentious field, and they like that. Well, that's okay, but you need to know in advance the kind of people who work in your field. The human aspect is there, including among researchers. And the specialists can be specialists in academia, but it can be specialists just in the media, for instance, that you need to, if you want to work on West African music, it might be a good idea to get to know who works on West African music, even as a journalist. And kind of second, but I think it matters more than anything else, and it's a huge part of ethnographic research anyway, but it's part of preparation also, is to make contacts with local people. And if you work locally, that can be fairly easy. And these days, it can be fairly easy if you want to work in a remote site, if you want to work in a field site that is remotely, well, geographically distant from where you work, usually, where you live. But it's making some kinds of contacts with local people in general. They don't need to be that directly connected to what your research will be, but at least to make some contacts. And that can be useful in terms of accommodations. It can be useful in terms of making other contacts through the snowball method with people who will be, in fact, connected to your project, your research project. But it's certainly something that is generally useful to do as a kind of a preliminary step to know some people. we don't do cold calls in ethnography. At least I don't know anyone. I can't think of a project that was done through cold calls. It's not something you would do. In surveys, you would do cold calls. And also, I don't know if they call it warm calls, but, you know, that you call back someone who, with whom you had preliminary contacts. But in ethnography, you have some contact somehow, some way in. And there's no guarantee that the people with whom you have some contacts will be the same people with whom you'll work directly, those quote-unquote informants. But there is a connection between making contacts like these, general contacts about, you know, people who can give you general insight into the local context, and those people with whom you'll actually work on a day-to-day basis, the people who will give you the more specific insight related to your research project. So if you want to go and work in Quebec City, and you happen to know some people in Quebec City, or you know that you can meet some people from Quebec City, and you live in, you know, Sherbrooke or Montreal or Toronto for that matter, it's good to have some contacts and then to use, you know, snowball sampling later on and, you know, follow the network to a certain extent. I'm passionate about social networks in general, and certainly a good time with the social web, social media in general, to actually think about using social networks. It's not just about business propositions, it's also about getting to know people and making those contacts, sometimes just for friendship that can last during, you know, your whole life, but can have an impact on your research. Another step that's very important, as soon as you decided on your topic, either about the field site itself or about the research question, is to start thinking about the literature and reading the literature. It's something I'm assuming is done universally in both academic and private research. It's certainly something that is required in academic research, that you need to know your subject very well, especially when you're not yet a well-established researcher. Because before you can get funding, at the very least, you need to know your subject. So I talked about funding before, but one of the steps is you start thinking about funding very early on, hopefully, and you read the literature before you finish your research project to submit for funding, because otherwise you just won't get it, at least in academia. That's not the way it works. I think in the private sector, it is possible to work on something with a vague idea of the way it works and find a client who hires you, and you don't know necessarily the context. Like, let's say you want to work on wine, or you have a client who wants you to work on wine consumption, and you then learn about wine in preparation for field research. But it's still a preliminary step. We tend to restrict ourselves in terms of the literature. There are patterns in terms of who we're going to read, whom we're going to read, the kind of research we will read from other researchers. Some of it has to do with language, for instance. Well, French speakers, we have probably more of a tendency to read those French-speaking authors that English speakers wouldn't read. And I'm pretty sure the same happens with Spanish speakers. English speakers, I've seen that happen a fair deal. Even those who work in a field that where the official language is not English, or at least the common language is not English, and there has been research that was published in a language other than English, to then still restrict themselves to English. French speakers, from what I see, we don't tend to do that that much. Maybe a tendency to us. No, a certain tendency that we still read mostly in French. I don't know. I don't do that personally. I read in both French and English. I don't necessarily read other languages, but at least those two languages I read fairly broadly as far as possible. But I do know some French speakers who only read or mainly read research in French. And for English speakers, I certainly have seen some people, and it's not a blame, but it's something I noticed, that some English-speaking researchers, even though they work in a French-speaking region, they still read mostly in English, at least at first. And there's something sad about that. I hope we can have more of a conversation. For instance, I must admit, I don't know much of the literature in Spanish about any ethnographic context that I've been thinking about. There is some about West Africa, for instance. For West Africa, it's not that sizable, but it's there. I'm saying it's not that sizable. It's certainly much broader than I know it is. But at the same time, West Africa is well known for French-speaking researchers, and then English-speaking researchers at certain periods. And nowadays, the two will have fairly parallel research agendas and not necessarily read each other that much and not go to the same conferences, actually. And when I talk about literature, I still mean about people, too. So people you meet and get introduced to key figures, even, you know, former figures, classic readings, but also, you know, current researchers. The literature, what's funny about that is it tends to preset some hypotheses we may have. So if, I don't know, let's say Marcel Griaule has worked in the cultural context and geographical even context where you want to work, it might influence the kind of hypotheses and the kind of questions you may ask. It's interesting. I don't claim that this tendency is extremely strong and it's possible to do a research project about anything anywhere, but there's kind of a tendency. Africanists in general, for instance, there are certain questions that we tend to ask. And once you become an Africanist, once you get to read African studies, you tend to think like an African studies person. And there are differences between, well, the three contexts I know the most, and I mostly know two, English-speaking North America, French-speaking Europe and North America together, which is pretty similar in terms of African studies, and then England. So those three contexts are fairly different. But then, you know, there are some patterns even between those three, and we've done the same readings. So it's the kind of context in general. I hear that a lot. It's the kind of, what, you haven't read that? And it can be annoying, and I think it can actually be a problem. I'm not ranting, even though I'm allowed to rant on the podcast, but there's this tendency to expect other people in the field to have done the same readings. I'm pretty sure it's more common in academic ethnography than in private ethnography, but I would say it probably does happen in private ethnography as well. And in fact, a difference that I see is that younger fields have less of that. I've had the opportunity, and actually the delight to do some stuff in food and culture in academia, but connected also with public and private sector ethnography. And I noticed that the ethnography of food, or food and culture, actually it was a joint meeting of two associations that have to do with food, culture, and society. And because it's kind of a young field, there's no preset expectation of what you're going to say, but even what you're going to read. And something very interesting happened to me while I was, well, after I presented at that joint meeting, is that I started asking people, well, I'm new to the field, so what do you suggest I should read? And I got a list of suggestions, which is something very rare in an academic conference that you would actually get in public at a presentation, some suggested reading. And I was very upfront about the fact that, well, it's new to me, and it was new to me, and it's still fairly new to me, but I think I know what's going on in that field. And there was no notion, I didn't feel any pressure of the, oh, you haven't read that. It was, well, you know, you might start with, in this case, they were telling me all sorts of publications by Berg, which is a fairly wide publishing house, but they've done a number of things in terms of food and society. So instead of going with preset ideas from readings I had done previously, I was actually asking, well, you know, what has been written and what should I do? In terms of preset ideas, there's a lot from famous ethnographers. So I mentioned Griol as an example, but there's a lot of that with some famous ethnographers. If you go do fieldwork there, you're in their shadow. Interestingly enough, and Griol did work in Mali, what was then the French Sudan. But his presence is certainly felt, and I'm using his figure because he's well known, but there are other well known ethnographers. So in this, in a sense, you're not in his shadow. You're also in the shadow of Germaine de Jeterlin or Dominique Zahan or Jean-Louis Ancel. All sorts of people like that, and on the North American side, people like David Conrad, Barbara Frank, Patrick McNaughton, all sorts of things like that. And it's fairly easy to go there with, like, for instance, if you work with hunters or with griots in Mali, Charles Bird has trained a number of people and has worked with a number of people over there. So there's an expectation. Even when you go there, some local researchers, some Malian researchers will tell you, well, of course, you know, so-and-so's research, who's connected to Charles Bird and actually Michael Jackson is one, and all sorts of other people in the region in general. And, you know, they expect that you know those people. So sometimes you feel like you live in the shadow of somebody else, and it's something that you need to be prepared for because it can have an impact on the way you do research. In terms of academic research, it's certainly necessary to read a literature to know what has been done and to not repeat what has been done. The academic culture is pretty much about not just novelty, it's you should avoid reinventing the wheel. I think in the private sector, there's a little bit more tolerance for, well, you do the reading, you can reuse what has been done, and at least just the fact that you present it to your client is work, sometimes can be work enough that you work, let's say, as a consultant, and just by the mere fact that you've done the reading, you don't need to, you can in fact reinvent the wheel. You don't need to invent something completely new. But in academia, you really need to see the holes, to see what has not been done. So see what has been done in terms of what has not been done. So in terms of preparation, it's extremely important in academic ethnography to really know what has been done so that you don't reinvent the wheel and that you're prepared to respond to any question about anybody who has done work in your field. It's especially a pressure for graduate students. If you're a well-established researcher going into a new field, you can be somewhat naive, actually. And people will tell you, they will dare tell you, but at the same time, it's kind of expected or allowed, at least, that maybe you haven't done all the readings, maybe you don't know the whole literature in a new field, there's a way to do that. There's a way to approach that. That, let's say you've been working in India and you now want to work in South America because there's some connection, and people will tell you in advance, so you don't need what the holes are in the literature, so that you don't need to do your homework as much. The homework will be done for you by other people. I think I've seen that from colleagues to a certain extent. At least it's my perception. Maybe I'm wrong. But that it's less necessary to do a lot of homework. Then in terms of preparation for fieldwork, there's the obvious preparation for what you will do in the field. So you've prepared your project, but it becomes a little bit more specific than that. So you start preparing your questions. And this is something I think about a lot because we do need to be flexible. So if your questions are very specific, it can be a big problem in the field. But if you have broad questions, that's where you can really do something. I think a lot about that. And when I teach, I usually teach ethnographic topics, including ethnographic research methods, while it's a general course, like a survey course in cultural anthropology. We'll still talk about ethnographic methods. And I try to train students to think about the ideal way, the optimal way to ask questions, to prepare questions. So I am thinking about Charles Briggs's Learning How to Ask, and it's a book that I would recommend to any would-be ethnographer. But I'm also thinking about I'm even giving the examples of talk show hosts. Some talk show hosts who are really good at doing follow-up questions. So you have a broad theme. It's not the specific question. It's not that you want a specific answer. It's that you have a broad idea in mind, that you want to get the person to talk about her or his issues, her or his perspective on the issues that you care about. So it's more about a broad theme, not even a topic, and then you can make it more specific. You go from broad to specific or vice versa. But I think it's a good idea to start with the broadest possible. In terms of preparation, an obvious one that I did mention in the previous podcast is learning the language. And that should happen fairly early on because it takes a while. But at the same time, it's something that you also do in the field. Obviously, if you already know the language that is used in the field where you work, it's not so much of a problem. But even then, there's a preparation in terms of maybe they speak a different variety of the language you know, or maybe you need to adapt to, you know, the kind of subcultural language or more, you know, more specific contextual variety of the language. And part of that preparation, at least in graduate school, there are often requirements for the written language. Written languages are pretty useful in the field, that's true, especially if you need to read literature in your field. Okay, so if you want to work on so-called Latin America, on South America, South and Central America and Mexico, usually Spanish is a good language to know how to read and possibly how to write. So written language, yeah, okay, written Spanish is a requirement if you want to work over there. And Portuguese for Brazil. Okay, that makes sense. But at the same time, in the field, we don't tend to write a lot, even with literate people. If you work with very literate people, you still ask most questions or you still interact mostly orally. So written language can be important, but if you only know the written language, that can be a challenge once you get to the field. And one problem in universities, especially in the US, is that many courses that are given in that language, in many languages, are oriented toward writing. And the whole training is about writing and then maybe a little bit of oral. So there might be an oral component, but there's always a written component. There are other ways to learn languages. And immersion is certainly one. And if you can manage to do some language immersion in a language that you will use in the field, it's certainly something that is extremely useful. And if it happens to be the same geographical site where you'll be working, well, you do all sorts of other things. It's very similar to preliminary fieldwork in that case. And in fact, a lot of people do preliminary fieldwork basically to learn a language. The level of fluency that is required at that point, as I was saying the previous episode, doesn't need to be that high. I don't think it needs to be that extremely high at first, because then you adapt during the field work, especially if you have time. Obviously, if you do corporate ethnography, typically they do very short stints in terms of the research projects, so you don't have time to learn language, obviously. But you also don't necessarily need that much fluency in that case, possibly. Maybe you could work with interpreters. I hesitate to talk about that because it's looked down upon. But there are different requirements for different ethnographic field research designs. And very often you need to learn a secondary language. And what I mean is fairly specifically, I think it happens in South America and even in Mexico, that maybe you will work mostly in a native language, like let's say you work with native populations, indigenous languages, but you also need to know Spanish. And the same thing in West Africa, it is my experience that as a French speaker, there are some huge advantages in terms of being a French speaker, even though my work was mostly in Bamana. If you don't know any French, it can be pretty hard to do certain things. At the same time, it's easier to learn Bamana and other languages if you don't know French, because you don't rely on French in that context. So it's the kind of thing that you need to think about, and it's a good idea. I actually know someone who was who had difficulties because of that. She didn't know that the people with whom she was going to work mostly speak French, actually, and on a daily basis, and they're intellectuals in Mali. Or at least or artists and people who tend to use French a lot, and knowing French was extremely important. So during preliminary fieldwork, she noticed that she really had to speak French, and she wasn't prepared. So she had taken courses in written French, but she couldn't even voice out the words, and that's a big challenge. I think it was very frustrating for her. So I'm thinking about that very specifically for her case, but it's a broader issue that you need to know more than just the language, the native language of people with whom you work. You also need to know sometimes other varieties of languages that are useful in the context, contact languages in general. So in fact, I mostly spoke Bamana with people who were native speakers of Bamana. And actually, I spoke a lot of French while in Mali. But even if you work with people, Fula people, it's quite likely that you will need to interact with Bamana speakers in Mali. So it's the kind of thing that you need to know in advance what languages you will have to speak. And sometimes you have surprises with that. Then there's some basic preparation that I would call, and it sounds weird, but I would call learning the basic culture. And I'm almost dismissive there because it relates to something that most ethnographers maybe don't appreciate that much, that we are reluctant about. And it's the kind of culture shock thing. you need to prepare yourself for a culture shock. That's something that we're really good at as ethnographers, that we know what culture shock is. We know what it feels like, especially when we're experienced as ethnographers. Once you've had it, you know, strongly, culture shock, it's easier to cope with it in other places. The concept of culture shock is one that is used in, you know, general population. Sometimes, at least in business, people think about culture shock as something that exists and that you need to cope with. We talk about it among ethnographers, but it's not a major topic. It's just something like, well, there are occasions during which you do have a culture shock. It's not something that happens all the time, but it might happen. And in fact, I might say it did happen to me, not necessarily in the field, actually, but it happened to me when I went to the Midwest. And it did help me cope with other things that were not culture shock elsewhere. So I went to Mali in 98, and I didn't have a culture shock at all. I really didn't feel a culture shock. I felt home for several reasons. I went to the Midwest later in the same year, actually, and I had a fairly big culture shock, and it was like textbook case almost, even though it wasn't about my research. It was about going to Indiana University in Bloomington. So I had a culture shock in Bloomington, and I felt weird. And then when I went back to Mali in 2002, not only didn't I have a culture shock there, because I didn't have one in 98, so it would be strange to have one in 2002, but I could place things, and it felt very different than if I didn't have a culture shock in the Midwest. So it's the kind of experience that you take advantage of. You need to have a culture shock. It's kind of like a rite of passage. You need to be homesick. I've been homesick in the past. And there's no, I don't think there's any guilt in that. No, I will admit it. Even though I was already an anthropologist at the time, I was homesick, and it's fine. Being homesick is perfectly normal, common. You know, at least in a statistical sense, some people don't get homesick much, you know, for several reasons. But there's something about that. And in fact, I might say, in Mali, homesickness is something that is known. Obviously, people travel. And is a concept that people use, and it helped me. Homesickness in general, and this kind of saudade, sweet sorrow, this kind of emotion that we live, it informed my fieldwork at that time. So it's a preparation that maybe you don't want to get, but getting homesick is something that you need to go through at one point. And I think it prepares you to be a more complete ethnographer. And still, in terms of informal preparation, it's similar to preliminary fieldwork, but it's to do different things that can be at a distance. And I'm thinking about some things that sound fairly silly, but can be fairly important. And it's something that we probably all do, but we don't really, you know, talk about, at least not in class. And it makes sense. So it can be as simple as going to a restaurant serving the food that is common where you're going to do research. So you want to work with, you know, Spanish speakers in North America, you might as well go to a restaurant that might be like, let's say you want to work with Cubans in New York City, but you might go to a Cuban restaurant. But even going to a restaurant that serves another cuisine, sometimes, you know, people will do that. Some ethnographers will do something as weird as that. And there's something to it. You learn something, but mostly, you know, you get in the mood. And I'm thinking about that, you know, my example would be to go to a Senegalese restaurant before going to Mali. And there are actually several Senegalese dishes that are meals that are common in Mali. Senegalese cuisine is known in Mali, and vice versa to a certain extent, actually. And, you know, you do something like that is very informal, and I call myself an informal ethnographer, I do more than that, but it's also something I can do that will inform, will prepare me for something more formal and more serious. So the food itself, or even the music, listening to music from a cultural context that you're interested in, it can be local, it can be about the topic itself. If you want to work on, you know, lesbian communities in some part, let's say Northampton, Massachusetts is a good context for that, you can actually listen to lesbian-themed music. It makes sense. Even for a man to who wants to do research on that, it can make sense to just listen, well, to do that at one point in preparation for the actual research, to do like, well, you know, to listen to it and you notice things in advance, and maybe you have preliminary questions that you may think about asking, but just something like that that can be done. And it's easy to do. It's very casually listening to music from Mali, and you know, later on, even if it's pop music, at least, you know, you get something out of it. You know, it's something that is done, and we might as well think about it. And it's nothing to be ashamed of, but at the same time, it's not the actual research, it's just preparation. Another thing that's just preparation, but can lead into other things later on, and it's related to what I was talking about in terms of making contacts, is hanging out with people. So if you want to study Cubans and you are in Cuba, you want to go to Cuba for research, and you happen to be, let's say, in New York City or in another place where, or in Miami, where there's a significant Cuban population, you might as well hang out with Cubans over there. Not that they will be exactly the kinds of people, or whatever means, but the people with whom you'll work later. But, you know, it kind of prepares you just by hanging out with Cubans in New York City or Miami. You might learn a thing or two about Cuba from a different perspective. And once you get to Cuba, well, you notice that there's a huge difference. I never went to Cuba. I don't know that many Cubans elsewhere. But I know there's a huge difference, and just by hanging out with Cubans elsewhere, and then you go to Cuba, you know there's a difference, and that difference will be generating some insights, I'm pretty sure. It's not that you've done the research just remotely, it's that, you know, if you want to study Cubans in Cuba, you need to go to Cuba if you do ethnography. But at least you have something, some background somehow. So it's something that can be done, and you might seek them out, and sometimes you can word them out that, oh, you want to interact with Haitians in Montreal, and because you want to do a research project in Haiti, well, you know, it might word them out, but at the same time, the stakes are fairly low that, you know, if you don't interact with them right away, it's not like your research depends on it. It's just like you start hanging out with people like that. There's something that happens. It's not the research itself, but it's there, and it can have an impact. Now, in terms of something very practical, and I do want to get more and more practical, travel arrangement. They're very important. It's still, you know, field research is usually traveling. It doesn't need to be, but it's fairly common, even if you do it in applied research in, let's say, you know, you're doing corporate research in Canada for an insurance company. Well, it might still have to do with doing visits in different parts of the country. So it's still about travel arrangements. There are also some projects that require no travel whatsoever. It's just a neighborhood of your city where you live full-time and you've been living your whole life and all of that. So you don't need to think about traveling or you know, distance or anything like that. But you still need to manage issues that are similar to traveling. And the practice is so tied with distant field sites that there's a lot to be said about travel arrangements and how they fit in the rest of the research. So a big part of that is length of stay. And I've talked about that before. Length of stay tends to be this almost mythical thing that you have to stay a full year at least. But sometimes you can only stay a few weeks at a time. And in some contexts, you can only stay a few days at a time and even a few hours. So length of stay is extremely important for many reasons. And you can still get something from a few hours at a time. It sounds weird, but it's still possible to get something out of it. And it changes everything. It doesn't change everything. It changes a few things. Well, one thing it changes is just your ticket. If you take the plane and you go somewhere for a year, usually plane tickets don't allow you to do that. If you have an open ticket, it's very expensive, and it's maybe a one-way ticket, and you get another one-way ticket. It's, something to really think about. So length of stay is pretty important. And sometimes if you can't change your travel plans, and something happens and, by near the end of your official stay and you need to go, and at the very end, you're like, well, if I had two more weeks, it's best to be flexible, to have flexible dates as much as possible. Sometimes, very often, it's not possible to have flexible dates for many, many, many reasons. But it's one that if you buy your tickets not thinking about the flexibility, and you could have had flexible dates for your travel arrangements, it's worth it. Most of the time, for many reasons, you can get sick, you can get people who at the very end really need you to stay for something that happens, an emergency in the field. It can be that you need to go back and forth. So many things that you need to think about, that a flexible tickets is much better than, well, I'll stay for 6 months and that'll be it. 6 months, okay, but can you change that date and how much will it cost? Length of stay is also important in terms of visas. In many cases, it's rare that you can stay for a long time elsewhere without a visa, and very often when you do have a visa, you need to renew it, and sometimes it's every 3 months, sometimes it's every 6 months, sometimes it's every year, sometimes you can stay years at a time in the same place. It's exactly the kind of thing that you really need to think about in provision of the actual field work, and it's the kind of thing that there's no excuse for not having done that kind of preparation in advance. Well, maybe there are excuses, but the kind of thing you really need to think about it, especially if it's obviously elsewhere. So at the great distance, if you can't go back and forth, if you can in fact go back and forth, so whether it's in your own city, but even if it's distant, but let's say it's 5 or 6 hour drive, and you happen to have a car and time and gas, and okay, you can go back and forth once in a while. Don't think so much. Even if you have to cross the border, you'll manage somehow. But if it's far and it's very costly to go back, it's the kind of thing you really need to think about it. And speaking of distance, there's all sorts of things to think about based on distance. Most academic ethnographers, well, maybe less now, but a lot of academic ethnographers travel great distances to do field work. Outside of academia, it's more, more common to not travel that much. But in academic ethnography, it's certainly a classic pattern to go elsewhere, to go the distance, literally. And that means that you need to think about such things as vaccination. Maybe you don't need vaccination, but very often you do. And you need to think about whether it's useful to have vaccination or not, because it implies different things in terms of cost, in terms of when you can travel. That's actually something that's not insignificant, because some vaccines require you to be taken, well, to stay for a while in the same place. Like you need to take three shots. You could take it in the field, but something like that. So there are practical issues having to do with vaccination, and it can, I'm assume, well, vaccination also all sorts of preventive medicine. So you need to prepare in terms of your health. So it's kind of obvious, I hope, but if you travel a distance, same thing with travel arrangements. Even if you go somewhere that you think is relatively safe in terms of health, it's still an extremely good idea to do a medical check somehow, that you go to your doctor and you take all the required cautions to know that you won't get sick. And what happens if you get sick? That's one that's extremely obvious, but it's important. Another one that's very obvious is climate. Well, that's one that has to do with travel arrangements, obviously, but in general. But think about the climate and think about the length of stay at the same time as the location itself. So if you plan to only be there during the summer, and it turns out that you'll also be there in the fall, well, maybe, it will change things in terms of the climate and maybe make things complicated. Not only for clothing, but even for allergies, for all sorts of things. So those things need to be taken into consideration. Most of us, as ethnographers, we're probably used to traveling anyway, but those things need to be taken into consideration. And also in terms of distance, communication is a fairly big one that is less difficult because of the internet. We now have means of communication that are, cheap, efficient, sometimes really optimal for the kind of communication you want to do. But communication is very important, and especially for ethnographers. I think it's something that if you're traveling for pleasure, for leisure, that you're just going somewhere on a beach. If you're a geek, you will think about communication. But if you're not a geek, maybe you want to be out of the communication channels for a little while, that you don't want your office to contact you. If you're an ethnographer, communication is extremely important. I think. Maybe I preach for something because I'm a linguistic anthropologist, I think about communication a lot. But it dominates a number of things. And communication is important also in terms of backing up your data. As simple as that. It's something that I was going to talk about a little bit later, but backing up your data is extremely important. It's something that you can do to a certain extent for some data just by means of communication. It can be online, through the internet itself, but it can be just phone messages that you leave somewhere. It can be letters that you send to someone. Those count somehow, that you have a backup. This kind of just sending a letter to someone that is dated, even if it's just a friend or your spouse, and you have that as a kind of backup. That's kind of important. Which leads me to think and talk about equipment. Very practical, but ethnography. Ethnographic fieldwork, the travel part of that, but also just the research part of it. You need to think about some equipment. It can be very basic. It can be pencil or pen and notepad. That's kind of a key tool that anyone ends up needing to use. Even if you have some sophisticated computers and such. Usually, when you do ethnographic research, there's something that happens with pen and paper. So it can be as low fidelity as pen and paper, but also all the computer equipment and such. think also about recording equipment, and I'm getting more hands-on and more of a what to, the do's and don'ts. But recording equipment is very important. Ethnography, especially now, people expect either in academia or in market research or anything else, actually, they expect recordings. And recordings, well, recording notes on paper is recording, but you need, you know, audio, at least audio, and if possible, video recordings as well. And that can be costly, not so much right now, but at the same time, you know, you need to think about archiving, you need to think about backups, you need to think about all of these things, which, you know, it's not just going somewhere. It's actually you're doing research over there. Those people who do surveys don't have to deal with that so much. They can actually just have the survey filled in. For ethnographers, now we have to think about recordings most of the time. And you don't necessarily need to be trained as a very skillful recorder. You don't need the sound quality to be so good, some of the time at least. Some projects you need the sound quality to be very good, especially like in music, because it can be part of a publication and some people expect you to have a good sound quality. But at the same time, you know, that you at least have something and think about that. There are implications with that. And in fact, we think about the even personal implications. When you go somewhere with a camera, people change. It's not the same kind of research as when you go with a notepad. And that changes everything. If you haven't done it before, it's the kind of thing you might want to train yourself or try it first with some smaller projects, especially before you travel. There's also equipment that has to do with your security. And in this case, I don't mean firearms, but I mean to protect your data. So I'm thinking about backups, but I'm also thinking about protecting your equipment. So if you travel, some people are very casual as travelers, and they're like, well, you know, they don't have that much equipment. Once you have a lot of equipment, you really think about security because you don't want to lose your data. So the equipment itself is not as important as the media on which you put it. So for recording equipment, it's not the camera itself as much as it is the tapes that you bring back. At the same time, you really don't want to have to buy other equipment, and you think about backup equipment and anything else you can use while you're there. There are so many stories of people who have lost their equipment or their tapes, and some people lose tapes, steal tapes just because they want to know what the researcher has been working on. So it has happened to a number of people. It's something that, you know, can happen. So you always have a plan B, and that plan B can end up being better than plan A. But there are expectations to think about. So, you know, it's better to be safe in those cases. Even if you don't, you know, you're carefree, ethnographic fieldwork is something that might make you a little bit less carefree. There's something in terms of equipment, especially when you travel, that we don't usually talk about that much, but it can be fairly important, is some gifts that you might bring to people with whom you work. In some cases, it's really expected that we bring gifts, and it's seen as a very bad sign if you don't. In some cases, it's like a nice gesture that you can bring some gifts. And in some cases, bringing gifts can be a challenge. If you bring gifts, some people might actually see as a bad sign. So you need to think about that, to learn a little bit about that. And what to bring is, you know, not so easy to think about. You might expect like, oh, they don't have this, but they actually do have that and they want something else. So it's something to think about. And one that I don't think, well, and nobody ever prepared me for it, and I don't think it's rarely frequently discussed as something you need to think about, but documentation is an interesting one. So I was talking about the literature that you need to know in preparation for the field, it can be pretty useful to have documentation with you while you're in the field. It sounds kind of maybe strange, or at least I wasn't thinking about that so much before going to the field, especially before going to an extensive field trip, but even for a short one, even if it's a weekend, sometimes it's good to have documentation with you. So now with the internet, it's possibly very easy to have that documentation accessible to you, available to you while you're in the field, especially if you do have an internet connection while you're in the field, which is the case in most places where we go at this point. We're not like geographers who are in the bush or you know, the forest, whatever, where internet connections are very rare. We tend to be with people, and we tend to be in at least villages, and maybe there's a very tenuous internet connection, but there's still a way to get a connection somehow, somewhere. So it's the kind of thing that can be good to think about, that you put things online, some even articles, academic articles that you want to pay attention to refer to while you're in the field. It sounds, I don't know how it sounds, but it's something that did happen to me, that I was thinking about some issues, some academic issues, and I wish I had my library with me. And at the time, in 2002 even, it was kind of hard to have a virtual library with you online. Nowadays, it's pretty easy. You can have a lot of documentation online, especially if you think about Google Books and such. So you prepare some notes and you have your notes with you. It's the kind of thing. I don't suggest that people read academic texts while in the field. It can be done, but don't overdo it. If it prevents you from interacting with people, you're doing it wrong. But at the same time, it can be fun to go back to academic readings if you're doing academic research, but even if you're not, actually. If you're doing non-academic research, sometimes going back to academic texts, academic articles, sometimes it does give you the insight. It's a kind of, oh man, yeah, I wasn't thinking about that, but it has been researched. There is literature on that, and I can now show my client that there is something to say about this concept, and you're thinking about it well in the field. There are connections that are made in the brain that can happen just because you're doing different things at the same time. And it's one that I don't think most people think about documentation in preparation for the field. Maybe they do. I wasn't. And there was even a book that I wanted to have while in the field that wasn't about academic context or concepts. It was actually about the Bamana language, and I want to have more with me to learn more about the subtleties of the language, and it was helping me. So I actually got someone to scan some pages from a language textbook, and it did help me to a certain extent. At least it gave me some kind of assurance of some of the things I was learning, and just a spark sometimes. So it's something that can be pretty useful. And I talked about the internet at several points. In most contexts now, I would say that a computer is, if not required, and some people actually say that it's better to go in the field without a computer for several reasons. It depends on the field. I think in most fields, it is better to have a computer or access to a computer, regular access to a computer. It's so much easier for so many things. So it can be for note-taking, and I take a lot of notes even on a handheld computer. It can be for communication, as I said. It can be for backups. If you do recordings, you can do, you know, quick editing and do backups and do archiving and do all sorts of stuff to notice things, to review some stuff that you've been recording, even present it to people with whom you work. All sorts of stuff you can do that's very, very useful. But if you do bring a computer, well, it means that you need to think about power outlets. All computer now pretty much can get any voltage, but you still need to have the adapter. So not necessarily the full converter, but you know that converts the current, but at least the adapter for the plug. But also in terms of security, in terms of what will be your modes of communication while in the field, computer communication, if it is accessible. If it's not, well, at least if you know in advance that it might not be accessible, and how much it costs, and if it's practical, if you need to travel 30 miles or 45 kilometers every day just to get somewhere where there's internet access, maybe it's not that practical, but at the same time, it might be once, you know, every 2 weeks that you will be able to travel there. And, you know, it's important to think about. And again, backups. That's kind of a key thing in anything that related to computers. And in research, it's something that people were probably talking about in the old days, that somehow make copies of some of your notes. I hope they were saying that. Nowadays, it's so easy when you have a computer to make backups and to keep them with you somehow, different kinds of backups. Even if it is a hard copy of some notes that you can, some messages that you're sending somewhere else, or even if it's audio recordings and you also have the text, anything, even summaries. Because if you work from memory, it's very hard afterwards. Once you've written something, it's actually easier to work from memory, and you know that from studying probably. At the same time, don't rely on your memory. Ethnography is weird with that you change your perspective so much during fieldwork that your memory is skewed in very cognitive ways, in very precise cognitive ways, that you don't remember things the same way. And I've experienced it. At the same time, I would say I'm still surprised by what I remember from 98. It's been 11 years. You know, which is not that long, but there are some very, very specific things. And sometimes your memory, your loss of memory is a tool that, because what is most salient is possibly what you remember the most, there are sometimes things that you remember and it's really the most important thing, but it's also good not to rely on that. And your notes, everything you take, think about the fact that they might be used by somebody else later on. It's something that's fairly important, that you want to share knowledge, and don't assume that nobody else will read your notes ever, or at least access recording. Sometimes it might happen without you wanting it, but sometimes it's later on, or even after your death for that matter, maybe it would be a good thing that your journals, that your messages may be kept for posterity. You can't expect what will happen. So a suggestion is to think in the long term. It's not just for research. It's not just for the answers that you want. It's not just backup for the data for research. I'm guessing that for a survey, they eventually throw away the forms on which those were taken, or they probably make backups, but they might not be backups of every single piece of data, even though they probably could and should. In ethnography, and for one thing, in surveys, very often, like, they don't take everything that the person has said. I've done surveys on the phone, and, you know, you try to take verbatim everything in the answers that are open-ended answers, but you don't take verbatim everything that the person is telling you, the respondent is telling you, while you're just introducing yourself. And that can be extremely useful and gives you a lot of insight, or gives somebody else a lot of insight. So in ethnography, we have all of that. We have all sorts of notes that are not directly answers to the questions we ask, that are not about the research topic, but that can be extremely useful. And it can create a completely new research project based on a parallel set of notes that you've taken in the field or recordings you've taken in the field. Let's say you wanted to work on music in the field, but you, in your recordings, you also had some recordings on the environment around you, and maybe somebody else could use it to do research on environmental factors and noise, and anything can happen. So it's the kind of it's my plea to back up and think about posterity. So label and things like that. So those are topics that I will talk about when I talk about the actual research, research methods. But the broad approach in ethnography is influential there, is relevant there, that we're not just thinking about data points, we're thinking about the broad context, and we're not forgetting that it goes beyond, you know, getting information about the topic. It can be much broader than that. Which pretty much wraps it up for this episode. It's actually very long at this point. I don't know how much editing I will do. I think it won't be much because it's a podcast and I'll do with it as I want to. I will put chapter markers. So if you've been listening to this in MP3 or even if you've been listening to it in AAC, Enhanced Podcast, maybe you didn't know, but there are chapters, so you can skip from one to the other. And that can be very useful, I think, because maybe one topic bores you, or you can go back and forth, and I think it's pretty useful in the AAC. I can't do it with the MP3 version, but I think it's pretty useful and fun. The other advice I would give you is that if you can, if you have an iPod Touch or an iPhone, or I think it might even work in iTunes, but at least I know it works in other pieces of software, and that you can listen to me at double speed. And I tried it with the last episode, and it works well. I like it. It sounds a little bit weird at first, but I've been getting used to this because I listen to a lot of podcasts at double speed. It's fun. It's kind of fun. As I keep saying, and it's kind of my, a habit of mine, I guess, or what people call a tradition, you can contact me. I'm not talking that much about feedback. I would certainly love feedback on my blog, on the blog for this podcast, or elsewhere, anywhere. It's easy to contact me. Actually, one thing you can do if you want to contact me in general is just look for Anchorly anywhere online, any search engine. I tried it. I'm pretty much the only one. Well, sorry to say so for the other Anchorlys out there. But Enkerli is my last name. And, you know, you can find me there and find my email and such. For this podcast and the blog and such, I have the domain informalethnographer.com, so in one word. I also have accounts on Twitter and Identica as iEthnographer, iEthnographer, spelling in a second language is very hard. And you can contact me there. I really like feedback on microblogging like Identica and Twitter. And you can not only give me feedback, but you can also contact me to, quote unquote, be on the show. It's something that I haven't pushed yet because there's a number of things I want to prepare. There's a number of shows I want to do, a number of episodes I want to do about general subjects. But at one point, I would like to have interviewees or even co-hosts or anything else. And I'll soon be teaching again. I said that nothing here would be time sensitive, and it's not, but so it's now August, and I will be teaching in September, sociology actually. And the context, while you're teaching, you know, you get in contact with a number of people. So it's really not impossible that even by the next episode I will have someone with whom to talk, or even someone to do a huge segment by her own recording, his only recording. I have a few people in mind that I want to contact, but at the same time, I won't nag people. Just that if you want to collaborate with me, feel free to do so. I'm there, and I like to collaborate. I think as ethnographers, we need more collaboration. I think it's actually one of the purposes of my podcast and my, well, the domain, informalethnographer.com, and the accounts I have on Twitter and Identica. All of that, what I'm doing in social media, it's not necessarily to meet new people, but possibly to collaborate. So certainly, if you're interested in collaborating, I would appreciate it. So don't be a stranger, and so long.